Our world has become complex and disruptive, and leading teams and organizations takes courage, determination, and skill. This podcast connects you to some of the great leaders to find out just how they do it. You're listening to Russell Boyce and Daryl Crook in conversation with standout leadership in a world of disruption.
To our listeners, wherever you're tuning in from, and welcome to this next edition of our podcast. Today, it's our enormous pleasure to introduce Vice Admiral retired Paul Madison. Paul, for many, many years, pursued a career in the Canadian Navy and rose as high as it gets. He was the Commander-in-Chief of the Canadian Navy. He then entered the diplomatic service for Canada and was High Commissioner for Canada to Australia and quite a long list of Pacific countries. And more recently has been, he remained in Australia and he's been working for the University of New South Wales as director of the Defence Research Institute located in Canberra. Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Looking forward to the chat.
So Paul, let's kick off with a little bit more insight into you and your background. Can you just tell us a little bit about your career history and a little bit of insight into the professional environment that would be a typical day-to-day situation for you. Paint a picture for the listeners.
I grew up as an Air Force brat in Canada. And so it was no surprise when I enlisted in the Canadian Armed Forces when I was 17. I chose the Navy because it just the whole idea about being at sea and seeing the world attracted me as a young man. And pursued that career, serving in ships. You become an officer of the watch, and then you become a gunnery officer, and then you become a operations officer, and then an executive officer of a ship, a commanding officer of a ship, and next thing I knew, I was commanding the Navy. An extraordinary privilege, and just a great adventure, amazing people, shipmates. Trips, deployments around the world, and all good things come to an end. I swallowed the anchor, or a euphemism for retiring, in 2013, and did a few things, and was surprised in 2015 to be offered an appointment as High Commissioner to Australia. And my wife is Australian. I met my wife on a blind date in Hong Kong during a port visit when I was a young officer. And we raised our family in Canada while I was going to sea. And she was the strength behind my uniform for over 25 years. And so the opportunity to come to Australia and serve Canada with me being the only member of my family who didn't have Australian citizenship, because we registered our children as Australians by descent when they were born, that was an amazing opportunity. So we came here. Just loved being in Canberra as a diplomat representing my country, and equally really enjoyed my time out in the Pacific Islands, those Pacific Island countries to which I was accredited as High Commissioner or Ambassador. And when that appointment came to a close, we thought we would like to stay in Australia if that was at all possible. And that's when the University of New South Wales popped up and asked me if I would come on board as the inaugural director of the UNSW Defence Research Institute, which has been a tremendous pleasure over the past 3.5 years. And what we do at the Defence Research Institute is we look for opportunities for our researchers across all faculties to pivot and be incentivized towards putting their tremendous intellect and experience and capacity into solving complex defense problems. And conversely, I spend a lot of time sort of barracking for UNSW amongst the senior defense and defense industry leadership in Australia with a view to helping UNSW contribute more and more by the week, by the month, towards in the national interest, towards discovering new, sort of concepts and new capabilities, working with defense industry, working with Department of Defense, working with the Australian Defense Force, to accelerate the generation of competitive advantage capability for the ADF operator, the Australian Defense Force operator, and through that capability also for our allies and partners, such as Canada, such as the United States. And this is all driven, Russell, by the geostrategic settings, which I don't have to tell you are really quite concerning. And so there is a great strategic urgency, not just in Australia, but certainly across the region, to be prepared, first and foremost, to deter the rapidly evolving strategic threat in the region, but secondly, to be prepared, if necessary, to respond and to respond decisively across the spectrum of operations to protect Australians and Australian infrastructure, Australian values, and those shared values in Australia that are common to Western democracies across the globe. So that's what gets me excited every morning when I get up to go to work, and when I meet extraordinary academic leaders and entrepreneurs like yourself. It's just a pleasure to work with you.
Paul, I'm thinking that across those three very different but interrelated aspects of your career, there's a lot of challenge, a lot of disruptive moments, and a huge call on leadership skills and attributes to respond to them. So let's go there. Let's start with disruption. Can you give us a little bit of insight into what did disruption look for you? Maybe with an example, as the Chief of the Canadian Navy, tell us about some of those times that things were going to custard and you had to respond as a leader.
When you're a young officer, or when you're a young, whatever profession you're in, and you look up and you see those who are the stewards of the institution that you've chosen to be part of, and you see, you see the authority they have, and the responsibility they have, and you think, wow, that must be really enjoyable, and that must be just, wouldn't it be great to be somebody like that, and just get up in the morning and have folks working with you and supporting what you want to do, and it's all pretty cut and dry. Well, it doesn't take you long to learn as you're kind of moving up the ladder that the higher you go, the greater the level of strategic ambiguity. And you just need to learn to, almost every day you get up and in your mind, you can envision how that day is going to play out. But by 8 o'clock, it's already, you've already departed from the trajectory, and you're responding or reacting to pulses that are coming from all sorts of levels, whether it's inside the Navy itself, whether it's across the Department of Defense, or whether it's across other government departments, whether it's in the Prime Minister's office, whether it's in media, or something is happening around the world that disrupts. And so you just have to be ready to kind of respond. One of the things that kind of cropped up very early in my command of the Navy was whether the submarine service in Canada was going to survive. And we had four, we still have those four conventionally powered boats. But at the time, the government was a bit, was wobbling on whether or not they wanted to sustain the capability. For me and my colleagues, it was just a no-brainer that a maritime nation like Canada would need to sustain a undersea strategic capability. But it's not always easy to convince politicians and senior public servants from other government departments of that same need. And so I remember asking the minister to be, to be the champion politically for this capability. And for a number of reasons, he looked at me and said, I can't do that. And so I needed to find another pathway. I needed to find another way. And without getting into too much sort of, inside baseball, I just had to find another political way to shape that agenda in Ottawa, so that the Prime Minister and others who were gunning for the submarine service would recognize the importance of the capability and sustain it, and we got through that. I went on to the equivalent of Four Corners in Canada to make my case for submarines. The minister and others actually said to me, don't do that. That is too risky. You can't control the media. Whatever you say will be turned around. The narrative that will be presented to the Canadian public will be negative. And I said, I have to do this. And so I did. And yes, the media did not includes what I thought were some of my very important persuasive arguments for the submarine capability, but nor did they completely twist it so that I, so that I failed at the task. So, and I guess what I learned from that particular piece and had learned in previous similar kinds of situations was you got to go with your gut. You got to know. You just got to, there's a voice that says, this is right. You need to know what right looks like. And as you go through your career, you come to a point where you're pretty comfortable, you know what right looks like. And so when something is compromising what you know right looks like, you have to do something about it. So right looked like, right for me was go to the floor for the submarine capability, do whatever it has to be done. And at the end of the day, it worked. And the other part of this, Russ, was you're doing it for the institution. You're doing it for your sailors. You know they need you to be out front for them, especially in this case, the submariners. So, yeah, a bit of disruption there around a critical capability. That's kind of how it played. That was 10 years ago.
Paul, there are lots of great leadership courses across the universities of this world and across all sorts of training programs and everything else. And yet, what I've just heard from you is a fantastic example of principle-centered leadership, values-based leadership, trust your gut leadership, quite often myself as a leadership coach, I get into this conversation with senior executives and some of them look back at me as if, yes, I hear you. And yes, that's the words. Others look at me like I'm talking a completely different language. How do you define values-based or principle-centered leadership? What's your understanding of that? How did it evolve for you as a leader?
I think values-based leadership at its core is about the people around you. It's about respecting those with whom you have the privilege to serve. And it happens on many levels. It's your inner team, like your core team. If you're the captain of a ship, it's your senior officers, your senior chief petty officers, but it's the most junior sailor and making it very clear to all around you that you value everyone equally, whether they're the most senior and influential person in your organization or the most junior sort of person that's under training, and letting people know that you fundamentally believe that everyone has come into the organization with a unique gift and that individual may not yet recognize his or her own unique gift, but it's there. And the aim of the leader and with those around them is to tease out that unique gift enable it, recognize it, celebrate it, and harness it, and get everybody in that team driving forward coherently, applying, you know, their gifts, and being recognized for it. So that's kind of how I view it. And I would also say that no leader will succeed in a sort of a values-based approach without being absolutely genuine. There are those who try to follow models of others, leaders that they've read about or observed, and there's real value in that kind of in that kind of through career learning by observing others and learning about others. But leadership is about recognizing who you are, how you approach the mission, how you interact with your team, and having the confidence and the passion and even the joy to stand up and go, okay, I get this. I know where it is that we need to go. I get the task. I get the mission. I'm privileged to be the one who is accountable for leading us all there. I know I can't get there without you. Let's go together. And by the way, I trust you. I respect you. We can make mistakes. I'm not going to hammer you if you make mistakes. We're going to learn and iterate together. And we're going to be successful. That's always been, I guess, Daryl, you know, my approach.
Wow. And I'm thinking of the many listeners around the world at the moment, young up and coming leaders who are just listening to this right now. And they're off doing their leadership development programs about this model and this theory and so forth and so on. And I'm thinking about the middle managers and the senior execs and the board chairman are listening to this right now and reflecting. Paul, was this a natural part of who you are, or have you worked to find it within you and strengthened it? And how did that happen for you? Were there events? Was it always there? Has it? Tell us just a little bit more about this authenticity, this naturalness, this natural inner leadership, please.
No, I wasn't. I wasn't a born leader, and I'm still striving to be as good a leader as I can be. I mean, I learn something every day about myself and from the others and from people around me. I had very little confidence as a young officer. I would find it hard to sleep the night before I was, you know, required to brief seniors on a particular task. I mean, briefing 15 officers scared the heck out of me, but then I'd do it and it would work. And what I discovered very early, Daryl, was the Navy and maybe the, and I'm sure this is something common to all sort of professions, but for me, the Navy had this ability to pull me out of my comfort zone. So once I got into a comfort zone, once I got to a place where I was comfortable with what I was responsible for doing, the Navy would go, well, we don't want you to be comfortable for too long. So we're going to now give you more responsibility, more people to be working with, and more accountability. And how do you feel about that? And of course, I wouldn't feel very comfortable at all, but I would, I knew I had to do it. So I would do my best. And before long, I found myself looking at myself and going, I'm doing things today that years ago I would never have dreamed I would ever be capable of doing. So for instance, commanding a warship, I mean, when I was a sub-lieutenant, I mean, the captain was some amazing human being who you know, ruled this this ship. And I spent all my time, you know, working as hard as I could to be an effective bridge watchkeeper or above water warfare director, so that he, you know, to serve him and the ship and the crew, and then to one day wake up and be in command of a 5,000 ton, you know, billion-dollar warship. It's just extraordinary. And if somebody had said to me back then, well, you know, if we cast out another 15 years, you'll be in command of the Navy, I just would have laughed, because I never dared to think that that was something that would happen. So it's getting pulled out of your comfort zone, and it's you know, proving to yourself and to others that you can perform at that level. And then one day there's just sort of a switch that happens, and you kind of look at yourself and you go, okay, I am in my sweet spot. I have worked hard to be comfortable with who I am and how I lead, and those around me, the feedback I'm getting is mostly very positive and constructive, and I'm very happy, and I don't need to worry about being anyone else, and that's a great feeling.
Paul, I'm hearing in that you weren't as a junior officer, and you know, on a what sounds like a regular basis, you were moving from rank to rank. You weren't necessarily aspiring to those positions of power, positions with stars on your shoulders, which I suspect many people in the military do aspire to, and then they get there and they've got the power that comes with the stars on their shoulders, but they might have missed along the way the personal attributes that are the things that will get them across the line in a time of crisis. But it sounds like you took it the other way. You were just trying to be the best leader you could be and kind of got promoted along the way. Is that fair? And is that the more important thing in dealing with crisis?
You know, when I was a very young officer, there were those around me who were much more confident and much more critical of the senior leadership, and who were quite confident in predicting that they would rapidly, you know, rise in rank. But I can tell you that none of those folks actually ended up running the institution at the end of the day. They kind of, I can't really describe why, but they didn't succeed. I spent 9 years at one rank while others were being promoted around me. I just had to work a little harder. But, you know, you can't predict. You know, a lot of folks spend a lot of time sort of mapping out, okay, if I do this today, and if I take that postgraduate course tomorrow, and if I get that second language skill after that, and if I do this and do that, you know, it's all gonna happen. And they kind of map out the next 20 years. I learned fairly quickly that I couldn't predict where I'd be 3 years from now. And so I just stopped worrying about it. And I got to a point where, well, things were happening. You know, and I was fortunate, you know, I'd get posted to a ship, and that ship would go off and do something really interesting from an operational perspective, which would then give me confidence and some recognition that would kind of, you know, help me move to another opportunity. And I wasn't sure if I was actually generating these opportunities or whether they were just kind of happening, or I kind of think it was a combination. But you know, near the end of my career, you know, the promotions were fairly rapid, but I had learned along the way that you can fall pretty quickly if you think it's about yourself. And so I just never let that, I never became sort of complacent with where I was or overconfident. I really wanted to keep focusing on the people around me and ensuring that as a team, we were excelling.
Paul, you know, sometimes I'll talk to leaders in industry, and and they'll say all of the right words and they'll use all of the buzzwords, and it's pretty clear they've been off to a course somewhere. And yet, when I follow them around, I don't see any evidence of the application of that. In other words, I'm seeing someone who's kind of talking the talk but not walking the walk. As I listen to you, I'm getting exactly the opposite experience. I'm listening to a man with absolute authentic humility. And the number of times you talk about we, us, our, the team, the people, and you're doing that so easily and so naturally and so honestly. And as the listeners are hearing that, they're probably saying to themselves, I'm starting to get a clear message here of the leadership attributes that really started to matter as they went through.
Thank you.
Can I take that? You're welcome. Can I take that just a little turn? And can we just touch for a second on the notion of situational leadership? There are times, to your analogy, when the seas are smooth, and there are times when the seas are rough, and there are times sometimes when a situation will require perhaps more assertiveness here or some really tough conversations or decisions there. Talk to our listeners just for a couple of minutes around that notion of situational leadership and just being able to adjust depending on the situation to be able to get that best outcome that you can.
You know, a lot of my thoughts in this regard go back to Command at Sea. When you get into, you know, there's nothing more exciting than being given a very high importance type of mission with a high probability that if you don't get it right, it could go pear-shaped, and working and leading a team through that. You know, in 2003, I was in command of a destroyer. I was given 10 days to prepare to depart Halifax to go to the Persian Gulf, and this was about 3 or 4 weeks in advance of the invasion of Iraq. And so, you know, leading the ship's company through that, preparing them for what was coming. There was a lot of ambiguity around the mission, supporting the families as around some of the anxieties that were being expressed, but ensuring that the ship, from an engineering perspective, from a weapons readiness perspective, from a human readiness perspective, that we would be good to go. I mean, that was really exciting, intense. And you need to be very, you need to be decisive, and you need to make hard calls. You know, there were folks that I knew just would not be able to come with us. I just needed to land them. There were others that I needed to go out and convince my colleagues and peers and other ships that I needed some of their key sailors. I needed some of their key critical technical parts. I needed others to actually do things for me, and some of that was hard, because I, at the end of the day, I knew my mission was to get a high readiness destroyer out of the harbor that was in all respects ready to do anything for Canada, including, you know, very much going in harm's way. So you know, and you do that with your senior leadership team, and you collectively, I used to have these conversations with the executive officer and the coxswain in my cabin. Some of them were difficult conversations. We didn't always agree. Sometimes it was 2-1. Sometimes it was unanimous. I was prepared to be convinced if I was, you know, going down a certain path for decision. But we committed to one another that whenever we walked out of my cabin, we refused on the decision that I had made. And I knew that my XO and my coxswain, when they went down to the wardroom for the officers or into the chiefs and petty officers mess or the master seaman and below mess, that everybody knew that the command team was in unison. 5 days out of Halifax or 4 days out of Halifax, my helicopter crashed. It crashed on deck on launch. Thank God, none of the crew were seriously hurt. The helicopter was a write-off. We didn't have a fire, but this was a significant emergency. And, you know, I had to, you know, what my crew looked for in that particular instance. I mean, we're talking about the initial minutes and hours and then days after that event. What my crew looked to me for was, you know, confidence, leadership, but empathy, and understanding around how this was affecting everyone. You know, I called the admiral at the time and said, "I'm happy to continue into the Mediterranean and towards Suez." And he said, no, you got to come back and we need to get that helicopter off your deck." And I said, "No, sir, we can carry on. I'll land the helicopter in Gibraltar and you can fly me over another, you can ship me over another helicopter." He said, "No, you're coming home." So I said, "Okay." So, you know, we went home and we got the helicopter off and I had to do a bunch of media. It was a big deal. But we were, and the crew was slightly shaken, but good. And we turned around and we were back out the door in about 4 days and zipped across, to the Med through Suez and up into the Gulf. And, you know, it was really interesting. So the Air Force shipped over a helicopter, which we picked up about 6 weeks after we got to the Gulf. And I remember going out into the South Arabian Gulf and landing, going to flying stations for the first time. And you could feel in the ship, across the ship's company, a certain level of anxiety, especially in the air department. I mean, it's a significant emotional event when your helicopter crashes. So that sort of traumatic memory was still there. And I felt it myself. And I could feel everybody kind of looking at me as that helicopter came over the deck and landed for the first time. And then, you know, and then we launched it and recovered and launched and recovered. And after a while, it was only a couple of days. We were, you know, fully, the air department was fully up and running again. But, you know, that's an example of disruption. It's an example of, folks being pushed to their limits and everybody sort of coming back and having the collective courage to drive forward because the mission required it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Paul. That these stories tell us so much about your leadership style, about you understanding the importance of people and culture and mission and purpose and these key words that we hear about, but now we're actually hearing the stories behind these words.
Thank you. I could tell you, Russ knows, I could tell sailor stories for a long time. When you're at the tactical level, you kind of focus on tactical proficiency. When you're at the operational level, you know, again, you're focusing on ensuring that, you know, the ships, the sailors, everyone are ready, that they're happy, that they're incentivized, that they feel recognized, they feel valued, that their families are supported. But at the strategic level, you know, when you realize that you're a steward of a cherished national institution, it's a whole different privilege. It's awesome. It can be overwhelming at times, but it's such a privilege, you know, to go out and, in terms of the Navy, speak about, you know, how important and critical the Navy was and continues to be. For a maritime nation like Canada, or for a maritime nation like Australia. One thing I found really interesting, I haven't touched on this yet, but I find cultures really interesting when you're talking about leadership. And so, you know, I really understood the culture of the Navy, right? Because I grew up in it. Yeah. And within that culture, there are subcultures. There's submariners, there's the air community. There's the engineers, there's the ship drivers. But then as I grew up and got into the joint environment, you realize the Air Force has its own culture and subcultures, the Army, well, don't get me started. So lots of cultures there. But then when you get to the strategic level and you're actually leading in the national capital, there are other really important cultures that you need to understand. It's the public service. It's the politicians. It's the political staffers. It's the media. It's the industry. It's academia. And you've quickly come to, well, quicker for some than others, but you come to realize the importance of putting effort into understanding institutional cultures outside of your own, and trying to understand how to be successful and influential within their value systems, because there's no one sort of Canadian or Australian kind of value code. And so I learned some hard lessons there as well. And when I came to diplomacy, you know, I led the way I had learned to lead, which was a bit prescriptive, perhaps, and a bit, you know, I like to lead from the front. I believe leaders should lead from the front. I don't get passive leadership, you know, those who kind of shape from the rear. But I discovered that in the Foreign Service, there are different kind of expectations. People have grown up doing different things, and they've observed different styles of leadership. And so, you know, people reacted to me as kind of someone referred to me as a command and control freak, which I thought was pretty rich, but I had to think about, well, why were they saying that? So I had to find a way to kind of back off and listen a bit more. And I realized that in that culture, even if you were the high commissioner, everybody just, it's kind of like the tall poppy syndrome. If you were too active and out front, there were actually people who would come and try to take the feet out from under you, which was a bit of a shock to me, actually. Mm-hmm. But now I'm in academia, a whole completely different culture, as Russell will know. The great thing about being able to, the great privilege about having to been in the military and then in the Foreign Service and now in academia, is you get to learn so much about the human condition, and you learn, you get to meet extraordinary people, and learn from them, and that keeps you young. Yes, it's just great, Daryl. I'm really thrilled with how things are going.
Paul, I think we've just heard from an extraordinary person, an extraordinary leader. And there's a number of thought bubbles that come to mind as I just quickly reflect over the last half hour or so. Insightfully aware leadership, tremendous learning agility, values-based leadership, ethics-driven, people focused, a good dose of humility, and equally a good dose of thinking skills. So thank you so much, Paul Madison, for your time today, for joining us in this podcast and giving us your insights into leadership in the face of challenge, in the face of disruption. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Russell. Thank you, Daryl. And thank you to all your listeners.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you again, Paul. Much appreciated.